We invite you to attend the January 2023 Nomad Offshore Summit here in Lisbon, Portugal.
This podcast channel is about you, successful international entrepreneurs, successful expats, successful investors, sponsored by ACJ Contact.
Prison. Thank you for sharing your time this morning. I know you are super busy. So welcome to those who may be watching us on the various platforms and those who are joining us here in Zoom. Thank you for sharing some of your time. So we do this every week, HCJ.tax. So if you want to have a look at what we're doing next week and the following week, just go to HCJ.tax/events. We're also doing an in-person event, you know, after being locked down for so long. Next January, end of January, we will be doing an in-person conference. We have about 20 speakers talking about the offshore world, immigration, taxation, putting together your international package to live that international life. So if you want to join us, just have a look at HCJ.tax/events. We will be happy to welcome you and share the information that we have. Now, for those who may be joining us for the first time, understand that we are licensed tax professionals, which means that we're not here to give advice. We're having a general conversation about general principles, and what we're hoping that you emerge with are tools and issues and ideas that you want to take to your preferred tax team. But again, we are not here to give you actionable advice. You can look at it as education, or you can look at it as entertainment, but it's certainly not advice. There's no way we can know about your situation in, you know, just a few minutes and give you some reasonable guidance. It just doesn't work that way. This is being recorded. So for those of you who are on Zoom, if you do not wish your image to be reflected, just keep your cameras switched off. And for those who messaged and said that they couldn't stay for the entire thing, that's fine. We are recording this, and you, for those on Zoom, you would have got the message as you joined. So this is being recorded, and it will be available on our website, HCJ.tax, as well as about 23 other platforms, including YouTube, our Facebook group, SoundCloud, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, basically wherever you get your favorite podcast, this will be made available. So you can share it with your colleagues, or you can just listen to it again if you couldn't stay for the entire thing. All right. So I would like to introduce Kyle. Kyle, would you introduce yourself with a few words? Welcome.
Sure. Thank you, Darren. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast. I'm associated with accounting and consulting firm. We specialize in international taxation based out of GTA, Greater Toronto Area, a place called Mississauga. And in the past, I have worked with a few Big Four accounting firms with their in their international tax practice, specializing in transfer pricing. So I'll be happy to discuss and answer if there are any questions here.
Okay, fantastic. So some of you did send in questions in advance, and thank you for that. But those who didn't, feel free to type your questions in the box below, and we get to them in the order in which we receive them. So without further ado, let's start with the easy stuff. Like, what exactly is transfer pricing generally? How would you describe the discipline of transfer pricing?
Yeah, it is simple and it is difficult because it's simple. So in a layman's term, when a multinational enterprise, a company, a corporation having offices, having presence in more than one country, and they're performing some business functions there, they generate an income because of those functions. So the tax authorities now want to tax that income, and since those companies are related, there could be potentially a tendency that the profits cannot, can be rather, tweaked to look like, more income in a low tax jurisdiction. That's what the tax authorities think. May not be always true, but that's what the reason or the logic for this transfer pricing regulations are. So when a corporation or their different group entities are producing something or providing services or generating revenues by whatever means, the tax authorities want to get their fair share of profits to tax within that country. So what is important here is that as a transfer pricing consultant or as an advisor, we try and look for the functions that are being performed by that corporation in one particular jurisdiction, and we try and split the functions which are performed in that particular jurisdiction compared to the other jurisdiction. So if you allow, Darren, I can take a quick example. Again, a simpler one. Mm-hmm. So if say a manufacturing company which manufactures say computers, and now they have different functions which has to be undertaken. There are assets, there are factories, there are other manufacturing intangibles required to manufacture those computers, and then they eventually have to sell it to make the profits. So one company, say based out of China, is manufacturing components of that computer. Then their related company in the US, they get that complete components, or they assemble it rather, in the US, or they get a full, as a complete set of computer, and they market it, they sell it in the US, or they market in other countries as well. So in order for the company as a whole to get the profits, it has a manufacturing function, it has a marketing function, but those are split between different jurisdictions. So now Chinese tax authorities and the US tax authorities want to tax those profits which the company has earned. So part of those profits belong to China, other part of that belongs to the US. So these profits are split based on what is called a functions, assets, and risk analysis. Somebody has to find out what functions, assets, and risks were deployed in China and what others were in the US. And based on that, the profits are identified relating to that particular jurisdiction, and based on that, these are taxed. But I'll be happy to discuss in more detail if there is any other related question that you have. But this is the mm-hmm. basic fundamental of transfer pricing. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it is mm-hmm. actually a tax-related matter, trying to tax the profits relating to tangible or intangible assets and functions, assets and risks of each jurisdiction.
Mm. Thank you. That's a pretty comprehensive introduction. So, every day as I share with you, because we have such an online presence, we get dozens, probably like 40, 50 leads every day. And unfortunately, the media, people watch movies and they have this impression that, hey, I just need to look for a low tax jurisdiction. I'm going to set up a company there. And then suddenly I'm going to save all this money in taxes, simply because I opened an office in another jurisdiction and there's some sort of shared services or whatever. So related party transaction. And the reality is that, yeah, you're absolutely right. Tax authorities figured this out like decades ago. You're just like a few decades late. They know that with related parties, there is an incentive to somehow shift the profit from a high tax jurisdiction to a low tax jurisdiction. So as a result, all these related party transactions must be done in such a way that they're arm's length. They can't be any way, it can't appear as if you're trying to shift profits from a high tax to a low tax. So yeah, this, it's so strange, and people get upset that when you tell them stuff, because the media or whatever, there's this impression that it's so easy, but unfortunately the reality is a lot more complex than that. So you mentioned, the functions, assets and risk assessment. And of course there are certain transfer pricing methodologies that are, you know, I mean, of course, there are lots of them, but there are probably a few that are more or less understood and accepted, at least within certain frameworks. Do you want to touch on those?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So there are a few transfer pricing methods, which are almost like globally accepted. There is OECD mm-hmm. guidelines, which we would be referring, mentioning, you know, repeatedly in this discussion. But those methods are, as I said, I mean, whether it is Canadian tax laws or the tax laws of say US or UK. So these are common. So there are about five methods which are commonly used. One is comparable uncontrolled price method. So this is as simple as you're selling a pen and you compare a similar pen and see if this pen is costing like $10 and the pen that your client has is, you know, costing $50, then there has to be something which is not right there. Or if broadly, you know, it is a similar thing. So since, you know, this is where the characteristics of the asset or the product is compared. So this is one of the most difficult methods to be applied. This is definitely, you know, this method has the most, you know, weightage. Because you're comparing prices directly with the prices of the other product, but this is something which in practical is the most difficult one because you won't get the prices, especially of the services or intangibles or other products so easily. So that is one. The other method is the resale price method. So under this method, you know, are related the gross profits when a resale is made are compared. So if based on, again, that functions, assets, and risks, an entity is performing. The gross profits that they are making because of those functions, assets, and risks is compared to a similar comparables, which are dealing with non-arm's length parties. So there are, practically, there are certain databases which you can look at to determine those gross margins, and those are compared. This is basically used in case of retail or retail transactions. The third one is a cost plus method. This is used in case of manufacturing companies, the example which I gave. So again, profitability is compared with independent, with non-related companies. And in case the profits of a particular corporation that you're testing is comparable to the profits made by independent corporation companies doing those functions, assets, and risk, you can demonstrate that your price is basically going back from profitability back to the profits is at arm's length. The fourth one is a profit split. As the name suggests, you determine the overall profits of the group and you split it between the related parties. Based on you know, what they're contributing, what they're bringing to the table. Mostly intangibles are you know, priced based using this method. The last one is the transactional net margin method. Here the profitability, not of the transaction, but of the entire company is compared to independent companies. So the example which I gave was where the Chinese company is manufacturing computers. So, and it is, since it is selling to its related party in the US, so if you want to find out whether the transaction is at arm's length, we determine the profitability of similar computer manufacturers, basically in China or at least in Asia, and compare it with our clients' net margins and determine whether they are dealing at arm's length with the related party or not.
Fantastic. Thank you for that overview. And I'm going to welcome Neelesh to informal conversation and informal chat. Neelesh, great to see you. Neelesh had some technical difficulty joining us, but he has finally made it. Neelesh, welcome. Do you want to say a few words and introduce yourself? You're on mute, so you just need to unmute yourself, please.
Thank you, Darren, for inviting me. I had some technical difficulties and I have not been able to join in time, but luckily I've been able to join belatedly. My name is Neelesh Patel and I practice in the area of transfer pricing Nowadays, I'm based in India. I'm a CPA from USA. Earlier, I worked in USA. And before that, I used to work in Indian Revenue Service as a tax officer, where I used to handle the gamut of direct taxes, including transfer pricing and international taxation. So that is my brief introduction, Darren.
Fantastic. Thanks for that. And so here's what we've done so far. We've just kind of done like a brief overview as to what introduction to what transfer pricing is, and we touched on the key methodology. Of course, within the transfer pricing world, there's the OECD, and then there's the United Nations. What is the difference between the two? Nilesh, you want to kind of give us your perspective on that?
Yeah, what I can say is that OECD basically is an organization of mostly developed countries. That is how we perceive in India, whereas United Nations seek to take care of developing countries. And when we see the transfer pricing guidelines issued by United Nations, it is titled as Transfer Pricing Practical Transfer Pricing Manual for Developing Countries. That is more geared to the interests of developing countries, mainly that profit should not be shifted from developing countries to other low-tax jurisdictions. OECD guidelines and UN guidelines, for the most part, do not differ, except for some small things. For example, location savings, where profit could be shifted from a developing country to developed country. So in those matters, the United Nations guidelines are a little bit in favor of developing countries. Otherwise, as far as transfer pricing methods are concerned, arm's length standard is concerned, how to apply the arm's length standard, how to carry out comparability analysis under the arm's length standard, all those things are almost similar.
Right. So OECD, there's the UN, and of course, not surprisingly, the United States does its own thing, right? So I've seen that you're US qualified. You want to comment on the US perspective?
Yeah, US has a detailed regulations, 1.482 regulations, which we call. Now, if we see the OECD guidelines, transfer pricing guidelines, and US regulations, again, there are not too many differences. Maybe some nomenclature here and there. For example, one method which is very popular under the OECD transfer pricing guidelines, which is applied all over the world, we call it transactional net margin method, TNMM. In US regulations, it is called CPM, comparable profits method. But it works almost in a similar fashion, not much of a difference. Second thing is on services, intra-group services between associated enterprises, related parties, connected persons. The US regulations are more detailed, I would say. Of course, in the latest 2017 and 2022 OECD transfer pricing guidelines, they have also included a detailed guideline on this intra-group services. But I think the US regulations are more detailed for applying it practically to determine transfer prices of intra-group services.
Okay. And the US is also different in terms of, and guide me if I'm going astray, in terms of the actual documentation. So like the OECD, the UN, they talk about master files and stuff like that. With the US, they speak about the methodologies, but in terms of the packaging of your documents, they're not as prescriptive. In addition to which, some of the forms like the 5471s, 5472s, they have already in a different way facilitate the disclosure of those intercompany transactions. Do you want to comment on the documentation piece?
Documentations are definitely different in different countries. Though OECD now has recommended this, what we call three-tier documentation. Local file, master file, and country by country reporting, that is for big MNCs having turnover of more than 750 million euros. As far as local file is concerned, every country has its little bit of difference. Every country has its own regulations, and there is some difference here and there. So in that sense, definitely US documentation requirements are definitely different from requirements of India, requirements of other countries. But primarily, it is all this documentation is for the taxpayer to prove that my intragroup transactions are at arm's length price. So this taxpayer has to discharge that burden of proving that my intragroup transactions between related parties are at arm's length price. As far as what evidence is to be included in the documentation, there could be some difference here and there.
And cool, do you want to comment on Canada? What's the CRA's perspective in terms of documentation? How is it different from other countries like the US?
By CRA, you mean Canada Revenue Agency?
Yeah, cool is based in Canada. So, yeah.
Hi, Nilesh. I can answer it if you're okay.
Yeah, please.
Sure. Darren, yes. But listening to what Nilesh mentioned about the US, Canada, in fact, is more aligned with the OECD. In Canada, we definitely have those three-tier documentation requirements, which are already has been made a part of law. And there have been detailed instructions on how those have to be completed. And if there, if there are defaults, even CRA has brought in penalties for that. So these three tier, again, as a repetition to what Nilesh mentioned, are the master file where you generally, there are defined contents, what has to be there in a master file. Broadly about the group, about what their products are, what their services are, and then a local file is more specific to that particular jurisdiction where for which you're preparing the transfer pricing document, and CBCR, what we call in short for country by country reporting, is where you provide numbers, where you provide data relating to the sales and your workforce, your revenues and other stuff for each country that you're transacting with. Secondly, CRA in general compared to, again, I'm sorry, I mean, I'm just trying to explain it the way I think it's easier for the audience, is that the US, as Nilesh mentioned, has very detailed transfer pricing regulations. Canada does not have. So Canada has, given an overall broad structure of how the regulations should look like. And that is the reason CRA often have to resort to OECD guidelines for additional references. So the Canadian jurisprudence is definitely even in the courts, references are given relating to OECD guidelines, wherever the Canadian tax regulations are kind of not very detailed or not very descriptive. That way Canada is a little different than the US, but it is very consistent with the other countries where transfer pricing regulations are there.
Yeah, sorry, Nilesh, you want to just comment?
Yeah, Darren, what I want to say is that documentation, whatever be the details and specific particulars of documentation, may vary across different countries. But basically what I have seen that they mainly contain these things. One is, what is the transaction which occurred between the group members? Number two, what is FAR, function, asset and risk profile of the parties engaging into that transaction? What particular transfer pricing method, as Kun was explaining earlier, out of those five or six methods, are you going to apply to determine the arm's length price of the transaction, and why? Why you are choosing one method out of those five or six methods? Why you have to rule out other methods? So you have to explain that in the documentation. And then for applying that chosen particular method, which we call in India as most appropriate transfer pricing method, what kind of exercise do you carry out? Mainly that is comparability analysis. Mm-hmm. So that entire thing, what you do while determining arm's length price of a transaction, that entire thing has to be documented and presented to mm-hmm. the tax officer.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it's all about the documentation, the justification. And again, you know, at the beginning, I was saying that the general public, the average person, has this unrealistic expectation because, you know, they watch movies, you know, they read something in the news and they see what Facebook or Apple or whatever is doing. And they think that, hey, I can just go to a low tax jurisdiction. I'm going to incorporate a company and set up an office. And suddenly I'll be saving all these taxes by having these related party transactions, not understanding just how much work goes into justifying every single transaction must be defended, because the implicit assumption with the tax authority and the higher tax jurisdiction is, hey, there will be a natural incentive to try to shift as much profit as possible to the lower tax one. And they don't get that. But hopefully, you know, this sort of interaction would help shine some light on that. Now, I mentioned some of the big US technology firms. And for a long time, I know it's no longer available. People, the media was making a big deal about the double Irish. I guess both of you are familiar with it. Generally speaking, what did the double Irish entail and what did it allow certain companies to do? Nilesh, do you want to comment on it?
Yeah, let me recollect my thoughts, because double Irish, I haven't looked at it after this European Union.
Yeah.
Has taken steps to remove it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, let me try to remember double Irish.
Oh, cool.
It was basically a structure where mm-hmm. income from intangibles, which is the main income or the major income of these mm-hmm. big MNCs, that was sought to be sheltered in Ireland, mainly Ireland, mm-hmm. which had only 12.5% tax. And mm-hmm. for this intangibles income, Ireland also gave them special tax regimes or special tax rulings, where from 12.5, it could be reduced to up to 5%.
Or even zero. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if your operating entity is located, say, somewhere in Europe, all the mm-hmm. income from operations will be routed through this double Irish structure, and ultimately nothing becomes taxable as far as operation is concerned, and your income from intangible will be booked in Ireland and taxed at a very low rate. And income from these operating entities are designed or structured as low value adding entities, meaning that their functional profile, their asset profile, risk profile is kept low. And then it is argued that because their profile is low, they are eligible for only low profit.
Mm-hmm.
Higher profit goes to intangibles. And under double Irish structure, that intangible income was sometimes not taxed or taxed at a very low rate.
Mm, cool. Do you want to comment on it? I know it's gone, but still. Yeah.
No, Nilesh has discussed it very well. And I just wanted to add here that Now, OECD and even the tax authorities in other jurisdictions as well have come mm-hmm. out with various tax regulations. GAR comes in. Transfer pricing regulations itself are very comprehensive to kind of, you know, control these kind of structures. And mm-hmm. now the latest TO, this Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, which OECD has just kind of, you know, have... you know, they've come up with these kind of broader guidelines are again, mm-hmm. You know, in this direction only. So what any taxpayer who has an intention to, you know, set up an entity in a low tax jurisdiction and park their intangibles there and then kind of, you know, just pull in the revenues because in the name of intangibles would find it very difficult. It's not going to be as easy as just kind of transferring the ownership of intangibles and sucking up the profits to that jurisdiction. So, and as you have been mentioning consistently, that it's not going to be like the movies where they say that, oh, you park your, some few million dollars in a lower tax jurisdiction and you're good. It doesn't work that way. It is only in the movies.
And of course, this is a great segue into the whole space of intangibles. I think that, again, looking at, I remember when it first came out, it was made public what Apple and Starbucks and others were doing using Ireland. And, because there were some parliamentary committees, the CEO and the CFO had to appear before certain politicians and defend what was in fact a completely legal structure at that point in time. But it did shine a light on intangibles and how intangibles were managed in a way to reduce the overall tax burden. Now, as a result of that, as you guys have pointed out, there have been so many regulations internationally that have been put into place around transfer pricing and around the whole the idea of economic substance and permanent establishment. Do you want to comment on some of the recent trends that are in play right now in terms of concepts of permanent establishment, especially when you're dealing with technology companies? Do you want to comment on that? I'll start back with you, Neelish.
Yeah, technology company. Now, yeah, let me also use this term, digital taxation.
Yes.
Is that what you have in mind? Yeah.
Of course,
for that, we have this recent proposals from OECD, Pillar 1, Pillar 2, what we call it. We call it BEPS 2, Base Erosion and Profit Shifting, BEPS 2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
BEPS 1 was in 2015.
Yeah.
Now it is BEPS 2. So there, the concept is, what is the concept? It is still not changed. These are only proposals. Yeah. I don't know how many countries will adopt them. Today, unless an MNC has a permanent establishment, meaning that it participates in the economy of a country to a reasonable extent in a permanent way, then only it should be taxable in that country.
Mm-hmm.
Permanent establishment, like we know, branch, dependent agents, like that. Now, two things have happened. Because of BEPS, one project, multilateral instrument has been signed by many countries. Under that, they have tried to close the loopholes of MNCs exploiting the old definition of permanent establishment to sort of argue before the countries that I don't have any permanent establishment in your country, so I'm not taxable. Because of these reasons, your treaty has this definition of permanent establishment in Article 5. So MLI said, okay, wherever possible, we are trying to close those loopholes. And that is one part. Now under BEPS 2 project, digital taxation, what is proposed is that even if you don't have any presence, no presence at all. Let me take simple example of Netflix. Say Netflix has servers. Let me take the host country as India or source country as India. Netflix has servers outside India. It streams movies, shows, etc. in India through satellite and all. It earns good income. Like I'm myself a subscriber of Netflix. There are many subscribers. Netflix derives good revenue, but it doesn't pay any tax. It says, I have nothing in your country, not even servers. No servers, no subsidiary, no branch, no people, nothing. So how to tax these people? So OECD has come out with Pillar 1, Nexus rule. They say, doesn't matter, you have nothing in that country, but you are earning revenue from that country. So based on that revenue, you should pay some tax. Again, it will be like allocated the entire group's revenue, entire group's profit. Some part will be reallocated, not allocated, reallocated from one country to the other based on revenue. So that is the concept of digital taxation, where in absence of any permanent establishment, you can still be taxed in the source country.
Thanks for that. Cool. Do you want to comment as well?
Yeah, just to kind of add to what Nilesh mentioned. I mean, it is just kind of moving away from what, the source-based taxation we have been kind of hearing about since early 1900s, where a physical presence or a nexus used to be the basic requirement to tax particular, to pay taxes in that particular country. So now the business is done very differently. These software or rather these companies employing digitization does not, as Nilesh mentioned, require a physical presence in a particular country, and they would escape the taxation, although much part of their revenue is generated in that particular country. So that's where this pillar one regulation, not regulations, but the guidance comes in, and where the profits which are beyond, which are more than the routine revenues, will have to be shared with the source country as well. So this is something which I know is going to get bigger, because although at this point the threshold is really big and they're targeting only the top tier companies for this, but it is going to get bigger, and countries where, and especially like India or China, where there is a huge consumer base, they are losing a lot of taxation because of these regulations, and they would be very keenly looking at how to implement these going forward.
Yeah. So just so the idea of permanent establishment, it was originally born in a different age where businesses had a different structure. It was businesses tended to need a physical footprint in another jurisdiction in order to earn money from that jurisdiction. But now that's no longer the case. Technology, the internet allows anyone to earn money in another country without physically moving there or having any presence, any related dependent agents or whatever there. And so as you guys pointed out, hey, countries, they notice this, right? And they put measures in place. And sometimes the threshold is relatively low, like in Singapore, where I'm based, the so-called Netflix tax, it's $1 million Singapore dollars, I think it is. So probably that's 700 or so thousand US. So it's a moderately sized company that maybe would need to be conscious of this. And the threshold could be even lower. I think, for example, next door in Indonesia, it is the threshold is considerably lower. So you may have situations where you're an SME, you're running a small, medium-sized enterprise. And by virtue of earning money online in another jurisdiction, you need to check to see whether there's some tax consequences, even though you have no one physically there. The fact that there's economic activity online and you're enjoying the benefits of that, there may be tax implications. So I've heard people comment, going back to BEPS, as you guys mentioned, BEPS, base erosion and profit shifting. They're talking about the various pillars, and there's speculation that, if countries carefully and judiciously implement the recommendations, perhaps in the future there may not be any need for transfer pricing. What do you guys think about that, Nilesh?
There would be no need for transfer pricing if, what did you say, Darren? If?
Yeah, I've heard someone comment that if all the recommendations of the various pillars under the BEPS initiative, if they were implemented,
if they are implemented, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Let us see, huh? Let us assume pillar one, pillar two are implemented in the world.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. Now, if let me start with pillar two briefly. Mm-hmm. Now, pillar two, under pillar two, we have to compute effective tax rate of various entities of an MNC group in different countries. Mm-hmm. And then we have to do something, what they call jurisdictional blending. Mm-hmm. In a country, say there are four entities, all four will be seen together. Now, to work out effective tax rate, you need to have income, taxable income. And what is the tax rate? Now, under taxable income, to compute taxable income, Pillar 2 clearly says, in the commentary, OECD says, that all intragroup transactions have to be carried out at arm's length price. That profit has to be worked out for intragroup transactions on the current transfer pricing mechanism only, nothing different. Yeah, now coming to Pillar 1. Pillar 1 speaks of three amounts, amount A, B, C. So one can say that, I don't know, B or C, they say that if an MNC has marketing and distribution entity in a country, then the basic return for those functions, marketing and distribution, will be allocated to that country, to that entity. And if that entity is found to be adding more value or performing more functions than basic, then something more can also be allocated. So again, that is nothing but transfer pricing arm's length principle. So under Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 also, this transfer pricing arm's length principle will continue, but in addition to something which we call global formulation, because the entire MNC's global profits or income will be allocated to different entities, revenue will be allocated. So there is a mix. On one hand, there is global formulation. On the other hand, there is arm's length principle. Both are both will be working together.
Okay. And cool, what are your thoughts?
Yes. So this global formulary approach has, in fact, been there for a while. And Brazil was one of the country where, you know, it was used as a main transfer pricing regulation, and they eventually had to move away. I'm not saying, you know, that was wrong, but that was something which had challenges for them to implement, you know, for on every situation. You can have a formulary apportionment, you know, you can devise formulas to allocate the profits for certain transactions, but sometimes you may not be able to do it for all the transactions or for, you know, all the situations. So so that's where this arm's length principle comes in handy. And agreeing with Nilesh, I don't think, you know, with this new, you know, formulas being discussed in Pillar 1 and 2, it'll take away the arm's length principle at all. Rather, it'll work in sync with each other. That is one. And secondly, I think just to say that transfer pricing regulations would not be required or would become ineffective, it may not be, you know, in my understanding, may not be the correct statement, just for the reason that, you know, the tax authorities are in fact becoming more and more aggressive, more and more stringent. They're focusing these transactions more closely now. And they'll so this will trigger, you know, trickle down to the taxpayers very, very soon, if not already, to have, you know, to look at their transfer pricing regulations, to look at their transfer pricing policies, to look at their overall structures more closely, so that when we talk about the again, this BEPS Action 13, which talks about country by country reporting, tax authorities are going to, you know, look at the numbers, and they're very easily, very quickly, they'll be able to find out that if you know, any jurisdiction is not you know, reporting their profits adequately or sufficiently, because they would they can see that you know, what their what is the human resource, what is the kind of human capital that is you know, is there, and what is the kind of functions, assets and risks are being done in a particular jurisdiction. And based on that, you know, are they making enough profits? It's actually the other way around. If they're making profits, say in a low tax jurisdiction with not a lot of activity, not a lot of substance, as we call it, that's where, you know, this country by country reporting is going to focus, and transfer pricing is just going to get a little more complex. That's what I see in the coming days.
Yeah, I would like to say something briefly.
Yeah.
Under Pillar 2, minimum tax of 15% is proposed. Now, how will you determine whether an MNC group is paying less than 50% in a particular jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. What rate is it? Is it paying tax in a particular jurisdiction? To determine that arm's length, this transfer pricing is required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you. So, you know, I'm thinking about the person. I went to a lecture in transfer pricing, and the lecturer did mention that, you know, I think he was being a bit provocative. But, you know, I agree with what you guys are saying. That's my perspective as well, that it's the opposite, that transfer pricing as a discipline is going to become more endemic. It's going to be everywhere. So once upon a time, like a few decades ago, yeah, you could set up companies related in different jurisdictions, and you could, to some extent, do what you like, unless you're U.S. exposed, because U.S. exposed companies always had the 5471, which imposed almost the equivalent of a country-by-country reporting from back in the day. But other jurisdictions in the world, you can more or less do what you like, with some notable exceptions. But now, I think transfer pricing, even, I mean, it rolled out in OECD countries, but now, as you guys have pointed out, the most emerging market, the tax office is aware of transfer pricing, the importance of arm's length principles. So it's going to be everywhere, if it isn't already. So that leads to my next question. That presents itself as a considerable burden, especially on SMEs, because in some cases the threshold is pretty low. So, you know, you're just starting off a business and you're trying to expand into a neighboring jurisdiction. And then suddenly you have the burden of, you know, maintaining transfer pricing documentation. The principles is one thing, you can figure that out, but the contemporaneous documentation of all those transactions would, you know, it presents itself as quite a burden, not just on the company, but on the tax offices as well, who have to police that. You know, how sustainable is that? What do you guys think about that? Neelish, what do you think?
Right now, see, the transfer pricing regulations today, yes, in different countries, they are there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Pillar 1, Pillar 2, they are applicable only to very big MNCs. Pillar 1 mm-hmm. is applicable only to MNCs having 20 billion turnover per year. Mm-hmm. Pillar 2, 750 million euros. So SMEs are not directly covered there. So SMEs, whatever is currently applicable in different countries, they will be governed by those regulations till the time they are changed. Mm-hmm. But I don't see Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 being made applicable to SMEs very soon.
Okay.
That will take a lot, many years. First, they have to see Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, how they are working, whether different countries are agreeing, happy with it. Because Pillar 2 means, you must have read that Ireland has increased its tax rate to 15%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now, a country which is a tax haven, if I park my profits there, it is not going to work. I have to pay 15% either in my home country or in some intermediate jurisdiction. And if that happens, that no tax jurisdiction is of no value to me. So the no tax jurisdiction itself may enact 15% tax. Otherwise it will lose tax revenue to other countries.
Yeah, but you know, I get what you're saying, but there are some jurisdictions, for example, Indonesia, where there is no threshold for transfer pricing. So like in Singapore, it's 10 million. Uh-huh. But in Indonesia, it's zero. So everything you need to. So I'm just thinking that if more countries are as aggressive and adopt that approach, an approach that basically drags SMEs into the TPE net, you know, that presents itself as a challenge to companies. So it's with that in mind. Cool. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes, Darren. So Yes, you're right. In fact, there has to be a balance, and I 100% agree, because there are taxpayers which are really small and medium enterprises. They definitely have a burden to kind of collect all this information, and transfer pricing is never a small bit of information. It is a compilation of a lot of information which has to go to substantiate your transactions and your prices. One is, the way you look at it, Darren, is that if you look at it only as a compliance, it is definitely a burden. But if you look at it, as a consultant, we often come across clients discussing this as well, is that if you look at it as an opportunity to introspect your own pricing. So, companies is performing a set of functions. And because it's a part of a multinational group, it does not know whether it is getting enough profits of its own, because there are employees, who have some profit incentive, whose remuneration is based on profit incentives. So if everything is like a kind of, looked at as a whole, as a group, and, internally within the corporation, they do not know how much profitability is earned by which company, they won't be able to kind of really implement any tax efficiencies, cost efficiencies there. So that could be, another advantage, if not a direct benefit, but, a compliance, once you're doing a compliance, once you're going deeper into your functions, assets and risks, and try and understand what value add is being done by a particular company and what value add is done by their corresponding, related party. So that way they can definitely have some efficiencies, but yes, that does not undermine the statement that there should be, this is a big collection of information which has to be compiled and presented to the tax authorities when they're asked for it. There has to be, a balance between how much efforts have to go into transfer pricing for smaller transactions, which may not have a lot of impact on the taxability, even may not benefit a lot to the tax authorities as well.
And Darren, in India also, SMEs are within the net of transfer pricing, because our thresholds are almost, it is like reporting documentation threshold is only 1 crore rupees.
Wow.
How much US dollars?
Yeah, how much is that in US?
That will be about $15,000. Yeah.
Wow. That is, you're right. That's pretty low. Yeah.
And because of that, in last 15 years, there has been a lot of litigation on transfer pricing in India. Mm-hmm. Lot means lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you are right that because of that, SMEs have suffered. Of course, they have suffered the brunt of litigation. Mm-hmm. And the cost of compliance documentation, yes. Mm-hmm. But that is not going to change now. India is not going to increase the threshold remove SMEs out of the transfer pricing net. We are not hearing anything of that kind.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, like country by country reporting, this 15% minimum tax, they call, it's 750 million euros or whatever. But that's just the starting point. I think over time, you'll see mission creep and you'll see tax authorities use it as an opportunity to slowly but surely lower that threshold to bring more in the net. Because, let's face it, most countries in the world right now have a balance of payments, sort of deficit going on, and they have expenses arising out of the crisis that we've just emerged from. So they have a lot of expenses. They have a balance sheet to plug. So tax revenue, all eyes on tax revenue. So the more you can collect, the better and the more attractive it is from a political point of view. So yes, you may start the conversation at big multinationals, but there is a huge incentive to just lower it, to get more in that net, to collect more revenue. So yeah, absolutely. So with that in mind, What are the key trends, if you had to pick up like three key trends within the transfer pricing space for the future to pay attention to? What would you say they are, Nilesh?
Yeah. What actually currently I'm practicing in India. So there the tax authorities are looking to looking at profit split method, which is one of those prescribed method, seriously. Like they want to look at a method which applies, which views the transaction from both sides, from the side of both the associated enterprise participating in the transaction. Whereas other methods are mostly one-sided methods.
Okay.
So profit split method, authorities are looking into what is the arm's length profit from a particular transaction and how it should be split between the two entities participating in the transaction.
Right.
That is, I would say that is one.
Yeah.
Second would be this, of course, intangibles. Intangibles is always a troublesome issue. Intangibles, because of OECD guidelines, very detailed guidelines, there is something called DEMPI, as Cool and others would know, DEMPI, Development, Exploitation, Protection, Maintenance, and Enhancement of intangibles, meaning that any group entity which is just a legal owner of the patents or the intangibles will no longer be entitled to book all the royalties or income, super income or premium income or premium profits from exploitation of the intangibles. Entities who participated in this DEMPI functions, all those entities will be entitled to.
Okay. So that's your sense as to like the key trends to pay attention to.
Second thing. Yeah. And third is financial transactions like corporate guarantees. Then because of COVID, this new model has come up. They call it what is the name? Intragroup treasury management. Captive insurance. Insurance.
Yes.
Because of COVID, some MNCs were not able to get insurance externally at a reasonable premium. So they've set up captive insurance
internally.
So in India, I'm seeing this mainly these three trends, which are novel, new.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. And Cool. What's going on in Canada? Like, what are the three key trends from a transfer pricing perspective that we need to keep our eyes on?
And first, my apologies for that wrong number. I mean, my calculations were not correct. It, 1 crore is equivalent of about $135,000 just for improvement. it's still a very small threshold, but it's not what I mentioned initially. In Canada, again, Darren, the threshold for documentation, although that's not your question, but is pretty low. One is that there is virtually no threshold for transfer pricing documentation. There are penalties. There is a threshold of $1 million Canadian dollars to report those transactions in a to the government along with a tax return. But most of the taxpayers, they are not aware that that you need to, and there are penalties if you don't maintain, and the tax authorities, if they do adjustments beyond beyond 10% of your gross income, there could be penalties. So transfer pricing documentation definitely is one of the factors which I would emphasize is key on this. And other areas which one is recharacterization, where we recently had an important case law as well, but that is more from the tax authority side, how they look at the transfer pricing mechanism structure between the entities. But from a taxpayer's perspective, intragroup services is something which we often come across with a lot of companies providing those services across the border or receiving it from the US. So that is one, although taxes, I mean, it is one of those which is difficult, where all those five methods which we generally have in transfer pricing, it is difficult sometimes to kind of substantiate the arm's length basis on using one of those methods. It is eventually, the TNMM, which is the residual method, has to come in to substantiate intragroup services or management services. So that is something. Otherwise, I think Nilesh has picked up very well. All these intangibles is an important one from a Canadian perspective as well. Although most of the business happening between Canada and the US, it is the US which has the headquarters, and they hold the intangibles either internally or elsewhere. And Canada is more of like a support, you know, functions that we see mostly. But yes, intangibles is something where CRA has been focusing, you know, closely on. So.
Okay, that's good. That's great. So, you know, from my point of view, I think, you know, absolutely most jurisdictions that typically didn't pay attention to transfer pricing are increasingly doing so. The thresholds are, some jurisdictions are high, some jurisdictions are low. Generally speaking, I see them being reduced, generally speaking, to bring more businesses into the net for obvious reasons. And I think that presents itself as a greater burden of compliance for, especially for SMEs, and something for them to really pay attention to, because the capacity within the tax offices is in being enhanced. So the risk of audits are increasing as well. And previously, you can probably, in certain jurisdictions, you probably get tax officers who weren't familiar with transfer pricing, especially in emerging markets, but no longer the case. Increasingly, they're being trained up and they know what they're doing. They know what they're looking for. You can't play games, like, you know, you can't manipulate things unnecessarily like you would have historically. And, you know, just something to pay attention to. And on that note, thank you very much. We've come to the end of the hour. I really appreciate you guys sharing of your time, sharing your expertise. And if someone wanted to find you, Neelesh, what's the best way to reach out to you?
Email would be best.
Yeah, what's your email?
Yeah, where can I write it? In the chat box?
A lot of people are listening to this and they're not going to be seeing
it. Okay.
So if you want to spell it, yeah.
Yeah, let me first speak the whole email out and then I will spell letter by letter. Sure. Nilesh@taxwise.in. And the spelling letter by letter is Nilesh, Nilesh at the rate of taxwise, TAXWIZE. In America, ZE, otherwise ZE, dot IN. Taxwise.in. Nilesh@taxwise.in.
Thank you very much, Nilesh. And you, Kul?
Yeah, mine is Kul Makkar. There is no space as you see on the screen. KulMakkar@gmail.com.
@gmail.com. Fantastic. Thank you very much, guys. It was great to chat with you. And for those who are listening, thank you for joining us. Again, we do this every week. We do a live stream every week, different topics around tax. To see what's coming up next, hcj.tax/events. Thank you for joining us. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Yeah.
All right.
So if you're a 6-, 7-, or 8-figure investor, entrepreneur, or business owner who needs a tailor-made solution from a qualified team of professionals, we can help you achieve the international lifestyle, the freedom, and even the tax savings you're looking for. Visit us at htj.tax and live that international life.